Mortgage brokers rode the housing boom to great heights. But when the market crashed, many lost their jobs. Two-thirds of these real estate middlemen and women have been thrown out of work in the last 2 years, according to one estimate. Kurt Nickisch of member station WBUR in Boston caught up with two ex-mortgage brokers to see what they're doing now.
I can tell it's gold. I can see the K. It's just worn off.
In a dining room in the Boston suburb of Tewksbury, Lori Souza is turning over a ring under a magnifying glass. Two dozen people are looking on. She weighs and sorts by carat, gold bracelets, earrings, tie tacks, and then makes out a check to the owner.
$300.
$300?
Not bad.
A year ago, Souza started a company that organizes gold parties, where homeowners invite their friends and neighbors over to sell unwanted jewelry. Gold is fetching premium prices right now. Souza's company is expanding fast. She's hired 20 people, many of them former mortgage brokers.
We're basically riding the gold bubble that came after our housing bubble. And when this is done, I have no idea what's going to be next. But we're riding the wave.
Souza used to ride the subprime wave as a mortgage wholesaler. She was good at it. In her best year, she made $800,000.
I miss it.
Souza says it's not fair to blame brokers for the housing mess. She says buyers were either fraudulent or lazy.
I wish some of these borrowers would be held responsible. I don't feel bad for those people. I'm sorry, I don't. You bought the biggest thing in your life and had all this time to understand it, and you didn't. You know? How is that our fault?
She says it's not.
Everyone seems to think that the mortgage brokers were the bad people. As in any industry, you've got the good ones and you've got the bad apples.
3 for 2 if you want. I know it's not a hard sell. It's a grapefruit. You know?
Today, former mortgage broker Craig Good sells grapefruit and apples. He runs a fruit stand in downtown Boston. Back when he sold mortgages, Good used to make up to $400,000 a year. He opened offices all over Massachusetts and was expanding into Florida.
I was greedy. And when I came up to that conclusion, you know what? It wasn't awesome.
Good says he was a willing conduit between aggressive lenders and risky borrowers because that's where the money was. He says he did help some deserving people get into homes, but Good feels remorse for his part in what he calls the obesity of the time.
There was a lot of excess. No irony, I'm 215 pounds now. I was 235, 240 pounds back in those days because, you know, we were eating at good places and, you know, we were living good life.
Nowadays, he's not living as large. He earns an eighth of what he used to. But unlike the mortgage business, he feels he daily makes people happy. Before, if someone complained, it's not like he could redo a mortgage, but he can hand out another mango now. Good says he'd rather teach his son the fruit business than the mortgage business.
Because you know what, for a long time I was glad-handing, rubbing elbows, saying hi, smiling, and there wasn't a lot of people that trusted the authenticity. And now this is, I mean, you know what, I wear a 4-year-old sneakers instead of 4-day-old sneakers. And you know what? I know more about me now than I think I ever was willing to commit to looking at in those days.
Both of these one-time mortgage professionals, Craig Good and Lori Souza, say they would go back into that business if the mortgage industry recovered. Good says he would do it differently. Souza says she's afraid it won't ever be like it used to. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
And it isn't just Los Angeles having budget trouble. The whole state is in the throes of a full-blown fiscal crisis. But it looks like Californians may get the chance to vote on a novel way to help balance the books. The proposal? Legalize pot, then tax it. So how much money would that raise? Well, that depends on complicated economic questions like, what would a joint sell for on the open market? Here's NPR's David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team.
Right now, the price of marijuana varies a lot. The government actually studies these things. Researchers go into holding cells where people have been arrested and ask questions like, what do you pay for marijuana? According to a report published in 2004, pot in some parts of the country can cost 2 or 3 times as much as in another.
If you're close to the Canadian border and can get, you know, Canadian bud, that's higher quality than ditchweed from Mexico.
Rosalie Licardo-Pacula is co-director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center. She says some of the differences in price are just differences in quality.
It's just like wine. There's really, really good wine, and there's mediocre wine.
According to that report, hydroponically grown weed in New York can go for $1,000 an ounce. The marijuana market is a real challenge for economists to understand. It's not a black market anymore, and it's not quite an open market either.
Yeah, we call it a gray market.
Over a dozen states now allow marijuana for medical purposes, but federal laws still ban it. And strange things can happen when a commodity crosses that border from illegal to legal. For instance, when states began passing medical marijuana laws, Pakula assumed the price for pot would drop. Because now, if you were growing the stuff, you didn't have to worry so much about being busted, you wouldn't need lawyers, guns, cars with secret compartments for smuggling. But this question has been studied, and it looks like the opposite happened. The price of marijuana actually went up. Pakula thinks the big reason is that when pot became legal for medical purposes, more people started using it. Increased demand, more people wanting something, tends to push prices up. Kevin Johnson is the general manager of a medical marijuana dispensary in San Francisco called Grassroots. The place is decorated like a turn-of-the-century saloon, and it does seem like more people are using marijuana these days to treat all kinds of things, like insomnia.
Insomnia, I'd recommend something heavier. Any of the purple varietals tend to work very well for that. Say, like Purple Urkel or Granddaddy Purple, or a purple kush. Those tend to be much dopier and sleepier.
Now, in a normal economic market, when demand goes up, suppliers, in this case pot growers, would just grow more purple kush, and prices would come back down. But Johnson says the marijuana market is still quirky. Before running the marijuana club, he used to run a bar, which he says was completely different.
When you make an order for your supplies, for your booze, you know it's going to be delivered on time, and you can get whatever Budweiser or Jameson that you need for that week. Whereas in this industry, you'd never know when people are going to harvest. Sometimes they'll just disappear. You don't know if they just gave up growing or they went on vacation.
If marijuana were completely legal, big corporations might start growing pot super efficiently, and people think the price could come down by at least half. After all, pot is just a plant, not that different from growing tomatoes. And price is important, because the cheaper pot is, the more people will use it. And whatever you think about more people smoking pot, that could mean more potential revenue from a tax. California has estimated that a tax could bring in $1.4 billion in revenue a year, though some economists think that number is high. A few weeks ago, supporters of legalization and taxation in California turned in enough signatures to put the question on the state ballot in November. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com.
Now, a question that has millions of Californians waiting anxiously for an answer. What happens if the nation's second largest city goes bankrupt? Los Angeles hopes it doesn't find out, but the city is struggling with a budget deficit now approaching $1 billion. And as officials cut spending, everyone is feeling the pinch, as NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
The neighborhood of West L.A. is quiet, middle class, and nondescript. I can say that. I live there. It boasts a mini civic center with a little courthouse, a police station, and a satellite city hall, around a public plaza that should be nicer than it is, says Jay Handel, president of the neighborhood council.
Here we've got seven of our lights that are supposed to protect the citizens who walk through here during the evening are out, and they have been out for weeks and weeks. Had you have come here Saturday night, you would have seen the area completely underwater because the drainage system hasn't been fixed in years, and it's because of the budget issues that we have.
And Handel says the impacts of budget cuts don't just affect quality of life issues. They can affect life itself, like the cutbacks at the fire department.
They reduce the manpower and don't have certain engines or paramedic units working a particular day.
So on that day, help may have to come from farther away. And it's only going to get worse. L.A. still needs to cut more than $200 million by July 1st. And the city's facing a deficit of close to $500 million next fiscal year. The political struggle over how to close those gaps led Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa to make an unprecedented appearance before the city council this week.
Please, if we could have some quiet in the chambers and welcome Mayor Villaraigosa.
Council member Jan Perry's request was ignored by a throng of city employees who packed the chamber.
OK, Okay, and if we can show some respect, please.
They were booing the mayor because he's ordered city managers to eliminate 1,000 jobs now, with more to come.
I do not see a scenario where there will not be layoffs, not only in this year, but next year as well.
City officials have drawn up a list of positions on the chopping block. They run the gamut from assistant city attorneys to clerks to truck drivers to calligraphers. Yes, L.A. has a staff of 5 calligraphers for drafting proclamations and such. Villaraigosa implored the council to realize the urgency of the city's financial situation.
We will not be able to meet our obligations sometime in the summer if we don't act now.
Which sounds so much nicer than bankruptcy. Still, the city council has voted to delay possible layoffs for 30 days while other options are explored. Councilmember Janice Hahn said she didn't see how getting rid of 1,000 city workers would help anything.
That's 1,000 people that aren't paying their mortgage. That's 1,000 people that aren't shopping in our stores. And I don't want to contribute to this bad economy by laying off people in what I think is the worst possible time.
Meanwhile, the council and the mayor are closer to agreement on other options, such as leasing to private companies seemingly everything LA's got, from the convention center to city garages to the zoo. But political analyst Derry Schrago thinks city government may have a hard time cutting a favorable deal with the private sector right now.
If you're behind the eight ball, somebody's going to figure out they can take advantage of you, and they probably will. I mean, you don't want to be bargaining when you're in a panic mode.
Many cities are short of cash as revenues have tanked along with the economy. But two things make L.A. different. First, initiatives passed in California make it difficult to raise taxes. Second, because of the sheer size of L.A., a city bankruptcy could have impacts felt across the nation, says Schrago.
At the stock market, it gets freaked out by potential problems in Greece. You can imagine what it'll do about potential problems in L.A., and so it could have a very dramatic impact nationally.
The dramatic impacts created in L.A. usually just draw crowds to the local multiplex. But in L.A.'s real economic life, the thrills, chills, and narrow escapes are likely to last for years, and a happy ending is not guaranteed. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
There are some signs that the U.S. is emerging from its worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. But those signs aren't evident in many cities across America. Take, for example, Colorado Springs. Last November, voters there rejected a bid to triple local property taxes in order to close a budget gap. Now, in response, the city has cut the number of police and firefighters. Community centers, pools, and museums are also closing, and neighbors are being encouraged to bring their lawnmowers to local parks next summer to cut the grass. NPR's Jeff Brady has the story.
This city of 400,000 people is one of a handful that's turning off streetlights to save money. A utility worker in a white lift flips up the top of a lamp and turns a switch. Then he puts an orange band around the pole so neighbors know the light was turned off on purpose. Then the crew is off to another light down the block. Shutting off a third of its streetlights will save Colorado Springs about $1.2 million in electricity. But that's just a down payment on a $28 million budget gap this year. Vice Mayor Larry Small says a lot of people will notice changes in the city's 400 parks. 3 years back, the park's budget was $19 million. This year, it's $5 million.
We've taken all the trash cans out. We're not going to be doing any litter collections in the parks. We're hoping the citizens will pack it out themselves as they bring it in.
All the restrooms have been closed. There will be very little watering, and crews will mow just once a month instead of weekly. The city even trimmed its police and fire budgets and is auctioning 3 of its police helicopters on the internet. Still, Small says that's not enough.
We did have a transit system that's almost gone completely now.
The city sold 9 buses and will use the proceeds to pay operating costs. Colorado Springs resident Don Miller has lived here for a decade and says it's just too difficult to get around town now.
Matter of fact, I'm leaving. My lease is up in November, so I'm going to get away from here.
Because
of the bus system. I don't drive. I ride the bus, and there's no bus service on Saturdays and Sundays.
In this politically conservative city, most on the street say the city just needs to spend its money more wisely. Shirley Kelly is among those concerned about salaries and benefits for public employees.
I think the salaries have to come down to be more even with what the private sector is paying. Seems like the city, from what I hear, and I don't know this as a fact, but seems like the city is overpaying their workers.
The city argues wages are comparable to other municipalities. Still, small government activists like Douglas Bruce echo concerns about pay. And when it comes to shutting off street lamps and pulling trash cans out of parks,
the government is using its typical tactic of making highly publicized cuts in order to make people feel the pain to some extent.
If that's truly the strategy, it may have backfired. In November, voters here approved an initiative sponsored by Bruce that further whittles away at city finances. Colorado Springs now is considering wholesale changes to the way it operates. City leaders are thinking about selling the local utilities and a hospital that could raise an estimated $1.3 billion. Jeff Brady, NPR News.